Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to be talking with talented magician, author, and host Andrew Main. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, Sherry, thank you for having me here.
Oh, I'm really happy to have you on the show. I love magic, so I'm really excited to talk to you.
I like it too, so we'll have something in common.
Yeah. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, my name's Andrew Main. I spelled A-M-A-Y-N-E in case you were curious and wanted to check me up online, make sure that I'm telling the truth, I guess. I have a varied background. I've been a professional magician for a number of years. I recently did a TV series for the A&E network called Don't Trust Andrew Main. I did not name the show. Don't trust network executives to name your show and handle your reputation is what I'd like to say. In that show, I would use magic to help people is the way I see it. Some people saw it where I was more kind of pranking people, but I would help, let's say, a wife get back at her husband by making his motorcycle disappear, or sometimes I would just give my own sort of magic street therapy by making things disappear that belong to people and putting them in things like vending machines and stuff just to help us understand we shouldn't be so materialistic. Sometimes I had to run away after I did my miracles for people. So it was a fun show that used an overarching narrative of using magic to help solve a problem. And then along the way, just having a lot of fun. And so that's the most recent thing I've done in magic that people can find if they look online. And then I also write novels. I have a series with HarperCollins about a FBI agent. Her name is Jessica Blackwood, and she actually grew up in a family of magicians and became a cop, where I grew up in a family of cops and became a magician. Along with that, my newest novel right now is Station Breaker, which is a base thriller. I mean, it's kind of set on Earth in space. I describe it as sort of Bourne Identity meets Gravity. And I also been writing a couple books on writing, including How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, which has been sitting in like the number one book spot for writing, you know, off and on now for like over 6 or 7 months. So I've been very proud of that.
That's amazing. That is something to be really proud of. Wow. Everybody has a different story about how they started magic. You were saying that you were brought up in a family of policemen. How did magic capture you and bring you to the magic side?
My earliest magical memory was my grandfather came to visit, and he and my dad and I and my brother, we came back from fishing. And my grandfather asked me to get a quarter. I gave him a quarter. He sat down on the table. He spun the quarter on the table. And I watched as this quarter spin around and around. And then he snapped his fingers and the quarter vanished. And I was impressed.
Cool.
Like, this quarter's gone, right?
And
he's like, where'd it go? I'm like, I don't know. You made it disappear. How would I know this? You know, I'm like, I'm 4 years old, you know. And he says, check your boot. I don't think I quite said this, but I'm thinking to myself, clearly you're insane, old man. And I take off my boot, and the quarter falls out of my boot. And to this day, I have no idea how that happened. If anybody thinks that I'm making this memory up or it's somehow been enhanced by time, I would say that science is on your side, but I will strongly disagree with you. It's exactly how I remember having it happen. And just seeing that just made me go, wow, this is a thing you could do. And so I had an interest starting from there. I started to learn little card tricks and stuff. I was putting on little shows when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, 7 or 8 years old, and that kept going. By the time I got to high school, I either really wanted to be, you know, my three things I wanted to be in life is I wanted to be a science fiction author, I wanted to be a scientist, and I wanted to be a magician. And it turned out I had the perfect grades in high school for cruise ship magician instead of MIT. So right out of high school, I sent off videos to cruise lines and lied about my age. I said I was 23 and got hired on a cruise line performing magic.
Cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I went on a cruise, and there's always a magician on a cruise. I think it's standard, I guess.
it's fun entertainment. You know, you can have a magician perform just about anywhere, and I have a lot of friends that have worked on the cruise lines. And I performed back in the day when there was a lot more illusionists, and so I was doing putting a girl into a box and cutting her half, putting a girl into a box and cutting her fourths, and all that other sort of large-scale misogynistic magic. And now a lot of it's more what we call stand-up magic, you know, or mentalism, et cetera. But there's a lot of people out there working, a lot of great magicians out there on the ships.
I remember the first magician I ever saw was in person was Harry Blackstone Jr. at a show at Magic Mountain. And my brother and I sat in the front row. I think I was about 12, and we just couldn't stop. We were just staring at him. My dad and I was just like us, but my mom was saying, come on, let's go eat lunch. We've been here for an hour.
Yeah, it's funny when you're a kid and when everything's new to you, and particularly magic. And magic's one of those things that it's just evergreen. And Harry, you know, Harry Jr. had such an amazing commanding presence. And
he was hypnotic.
Oh yeah, his voice. You know, he and his father Harry Blackstone Sr., who I kind of loosely based one of my characters in the Jessica Blackwood's father sort of on him. He's more based on somebody else, but as a performer, somewhat like him. And, you know, the father was this elfin sort of short kind of wiry guy and, you know, very impish. And then his son, Harry Jr., had this very deep classical sort of voice that you would associate with a magician.
Mm-hmm.
And two different styles, but the same family show, you know, been in, you know, family for generations. You know, incredible to see, you know, what they kept and what was updated.
That is so cool. Yeah, he was amazing. That was the first live thing I'd ever seen. It was like, you know how they used to have, I don't know how long have you lived in LA, but when I was a kid and a teenager in Magic Mountain, they had amazing things. Like they had Diana Ross and they had the Lionel Richie and really big groups used to play Magic Mountain when I was very young. And so they had big headlining magicians and all kinds of people on the stage there. And so we would sit there, and it's free. It was part of Magic Mountain. It wasn't a separate ticket. And so I my mom was like, we've been here over an hour. Let's eat. I'm hungry.
Oh, yeah. They just, the parents just don't have patience. Yeah. And it was a loss. We lost Harry. Actually it would be, I think, Saturday or Sunday this week from 1997, you know, it was May 15th or 14th, something like that. And, you know, he's one of those people that, you know, with the loss of Harry Blackstone Jr. and Doug Henning is, you know, those were two guys that were so pivotal in sort of the transition of magic from, you know, Blackstone Jr. and taking over the father's show and bringing something that was, you know, his father was a contemporary to Houdini and bringing a show from that period into modern times. And then Doug Henning, who was a guy who pioneered magic on television and who, you know, older people today have a very fond, you know, remembrance of because of just how much fun he was and how different he was.
I love
and,
Doug Henning.
You know,
yeah, he was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those. Those were great shows. And the thing
mm-hmm.
is that variety shows just don't really exist anymore. I mean, it's sort of sad. I mean, they call things variety shows that just aren't variety shows. I grew up in the era of Carol Burnett, you know.
mm-hmm.
That's where the great people, like, I think even Harry Blackstone Sr. was on the Carol Burnett show during the early days, if I remember right.
Oh, wow.
I think he was one of the I mean, she would have anybody mm-hmm. she adored on that show. So, in fact, they surprised her one year with Jimmy Stewart, who was her favorite movie star.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be possibly. But I think the variety show certainly area was a very, 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 you know, interesting period of time. And, you know, one of the things that happened is that we had this kind of the variety shows went on and became, you know, music videos. You know, it became, you know, MTV to an extent. It became, you know, comedy channels, and it went in all these different directions. And we didn't get that sort of, you know, that 1 hour format. And the closest we have now would be like America's Got Talent or these shows, but the competition shows. And so there is that edge to it now, which I think makes it maybe not as fun in some regards, because you have to choose somebody to root for instead of just hoping to be delighted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the talent that, I'm sorry, I really miss it. I'm missing like that family of players every week. That they just don't have anymore. And like they had magicians, they had singers, they had dancers, they had junglers, they had every kind of people a part of it. It was sort of like a little circus every week.
Right. Well,
with
you know,
sketches,
you
singing.
Yeah, you know, certainly late night television tries to fill that gap in to some degree, and every late night show has their own sort of way they want to do that. You know, the Jimmy Fallon show likes to do a lot of musical stuff, and, you know, he'll have magicians on, but they tend to like for very traditional sort of style magic, you know, versus, and then you get the Ellen. Ellen has had a number of magicians on her show and some variety people, but it's a talk show. And yeah, that variety format, which really kind of, I think, you know, we saw the high point was certainly in the 70s, and that's when Doug Henning became famous, and that's when David Copperfield became famous, and David Copperfield is still going strong.
Yo, David Copperfield's amazing, yeah. I mean, I remember when he made the plane disappear.
Yeah, making the Learjet disappear with on the tail fin. I remember seeing that. I think I had to watch that on video, and seeing that when he had his logo was on the edge, and it was a Nagel, who was the illustrator who did the very iconic 80s era illustrator of sort of the line drawings that looked almost cartoon-like, and seeing David Copperfield's face on there, and I'm like, this guy's got his own jet? And,
yeah.
You know, turned out, you know, David didn't even drive, but...
He did, it wasn't his, yeah, but it was okay. He still made it disappear.
Easily now, the guy's worth close to $1 billion, and you know, he's succeeded quite well.
But I don't think does he fly?
I mean, not personally. I mean, he won't get behind the steering wheel itself.
Well, I mean, like Harrison Ford, there are people who fly their own planes, so it's a possibility.
Yeah. No, it's certainly true. I know, David. Just the idea of David flying, taking the wheel of something is would be surprising. You know, he doesn't even drive a car, so.
I would, okay, that makes sense.
Very New Yorker.
No, but I just think it's funny. Poor guy. No, but he's amazing. I love him. I've watched him, like you said, on everything, Johnny Carson, all those shows when I was growing up. So, yeah. I never saw him at the Magic Castle my few times there, so I would love to have seen that.
Copperfield? Or who are we talking about?
Copperfield.
Oh, yeah. We would never see him probably there. Yeah, his show in Vegas at the MGM is a great show. I mean, it's an amazing show. It's just you see the scale of what happens in that show, and it's hard. You know, nobody comes close. It's just that there are sometimes, you know, you might get a show where people have thrown a lot of money into production design or something like that, but they haven't thrown anywhere near as much thought into the scale, the magic, and making it as good as it can be. And he's a guy that's constantly innovating and. Highly, highly recommend if you're in Vegas, you get a chance to see his show. Totally do it. Him and Penn and Teller are just doing great, great magic.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. I haven't been to Vegas in a long time, but I'd love to see that. We're at the halfway point, so I wanted to give you a chance to plug your books, whichever ones you want to talk about, and just tell you've given a little sketch, but the one you really are launching, just tell what it's about and where people can get it.
Well, right now, my latest novel out is Station Breaker, which I shamelessly inserted a plug-in for before. And the idea right now of space travel is very interesting. You know, you have SpaceX, which just did their third landing of a rocket of their the first stage on this time, second time on a barge. They've done it once on land, and this last landing they did a week ago was an incredibly difficult one to pull off, because here you're sending this 60-foot-tall rocket with a payload on top up into the orbit, and then the lower stage is going, you know, coming back down at thousands of miles an hour, and has to do a reversal midair and do a thruster burn to slow itself down, and then land on a postage stamp sized barge in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It's an incredible achievement. And things are happening very fast with space, because you have Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, which is doing suborbital rockets, but still landing them and taking them off, having them take off again. Virgin Galactic is working on their systems. There's a lot of really cool things happening on space that, if you're paying attention, you realize that, you know, 10 years from now, things are going to look very differently than they are today. And you get, you know, what we call kind of like a phase change, where things seem to be sort of going along normally, then all of a sudden everything is different. You know, email, you know, 20 years ago, the idea of having an email account was like, well, I guess you could have one. And now, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Cell phones that are computers, you know, it's like, oh, it's kind of a cool thing. And now, well, that's the norm, you know. And I think that's happening with space travel, is that, or space technology, is that we're in the middle of a phase change where, you know, probably within a decade or 15 years, we're going to be having far more things taking people into space, doing far more things into space, building space stations, and radically kind of accelerating our growth of that because of reusable systems, because private enterprise has gotten this into a big way. And I thought that'd make a great backdrop for a story. And so Station Breaker takes place in the very, very near future with an astronaut named Dave Dixon. It's his first time to be able to go up into space. He's working for a company that's kind of like a SpaceX company, but maybe more like their, you know, kind of a knockoff. And on his very first mission, they're taking an astronaut to the International Space Station. They have a crisis all of a sudden as soon as they reach orbit, and they have to do an emergency docking procedure with a Russian space station. And he's a little bit suspicious of why this happens, and he's also very nervous about his commander, because he saw his commander in the ready room put a pistol into his spacesuit. And all hell breaks loose once they do the dock, and he realizes there's some sort of covert mission going on that went wrong, and he has to eject. And basically, he's wanted by the Russians, he was wanted by the Americans, he's wanted by everybody, and he doesn't know why, and he lands in the middle of Brazil, and it becomes this nation-hopping chase as he's trying to find out what's going on.
Sounds fascinating. Is this going to be a series, or is this a one-off?
It's a series. It's a standalone. That story you get completion and closure to. But what I wanted to do is set up this sort of environment of what's it like when we're sending rockets up every day, and we have to, you know, what is the political climate like in that, where you're having dozens of space stations and even more, and you get into the militarization of space. And I wanted to do kind of a, use it as sort of a launching point for sort of a Tom Clancy-esque sort of series about this era of space that we're entering into. So the second book is written and will be available in a couple months, actually. And so it'll be a continuing story about this as it evolves into kind of this first response to how do you handle these emergencies and crises in orbit.
That sounds really fun. Are you going to be doing any book signings, or are there any online events that are going to be coming up or anything for this or any of your other books?
So for this book, this one I put out myself. So I'll be, you know, doing most of my focuses. I hop on Facebook Live a lot. I have my facebook.com/AndrewMaine, and I do a lot of live chats with people to talk about the books and just in general about writing. I've done these also with my buddies, Peter J. Wax. Peter and I have done a few of these, and Steven Sears, who you know too. And I like to kind of sort of interact that way with it. I might be doing, you know, I might schedule some stuff, you know, if I could do some appearances that were tied into space stuff, I would do it. But I had a lot of fun just going online and just talking to people, you know, just opening up a live stream and just hanging out, you know, with 100 people and just talking about books, talking about space.
Did you do research? I mean, did you talk to any astronauts or how did you go about doing research for the book?
I've been to the SpaceX factory more times than I should probably tell people. I've been super into space exploration. It's been a passion for me in space technology. So it was one of these things when it was funny because I was either going to sit down and write a historical book that was a sequel to something else I'd done. And I said, you know what, I need to do more research. So why don't I just go jump into a book about space, because I've got just all these little facts have been sitting around in my head that I've been waiting to put into a book. But along the way, absolutely putting in, you know, doing research and doing that. And the book is told from the first person point of view of David Dixon. And so as you're following along what's going on with him, he's kind of telling you about a little bit about space history, why this thing is important, what it means to be, you know, how to do a reentry and what goes wrong in reentries. And so it's very, very science based in that. So it's not I'm not inventing new physics. I'm not inventing new technologies. Every bit of technology there is either on the launch pad or being tested right now in some capacity. And I wanted to make it there's so much cool stuff happening right now. Why not just use that as a basis? And as the series expands, I get into other things I think people might be kind of curious to find out about that don't get as much attention, but crazy ideas about, you have space stations, but then you can have high altitude platforms that are lighter than air balloon systems that are at 140,000 feet up, not quite technically the edge of space, but it's dark sky territory. It looks like night in the middle of the day. You would see very interesting electrical phenomenon from auroras to sprites to trolls to all these other kinds of curious sort of plasma discharges and stuff. And it's a very exotic environment that we're very unfamiliar with, that nobody, humans go through there. They never spend a lot of time there observing. So it becomes this really, you know, a fun way for me to sort of tell a story against this backdrop of things that I found interesting since I was a kid.
That's cool. That's a really great idea. And you're having fun with it, I can tell.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I have a lot of listeners that are writers or beginning writers. Do you have any advice, since you write books about that?
Yeah, my two books that I put out on writing, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours and The Cure for Writer's Block, which is the newest one, come from the point of view that I'm a guy still trying to figure things out. And when I decided I was going to be, you know, doing writing full time, I made a decision that every time I write a book, I would stop and then read a book on writing and then treat it as an evolving thing, because I was so nervous about putting my first book out there, because it's just, you want it to be good. And my first book was a book called Public Enemy Zero, which now is optioned by the producers of the film Still Alice, which Julianne Moore got the Academy Award for, and which is flattering, you know, to have a high-level producer like that come in and pick up the rights to that book. That book, though, I wasn't sure if I should release it. I was like, man, I finished it. It was my first novel. I didn't know if it was good or not. I knew I was going to do the indie route, and I had that anxiety about it, but I told myself, okay, have a few friends read it. If it's good, put it out there. If you get a hesitation, if you get what you know is qualified praise, meaning that if they're telling you they like it, but you know they don't, then don't do it. And I got unqualified praise. Everybody loved it. My friend circle did, at least. And so I put it out there, and it was the best thing I could have ever done. This was a book that I was a coin toss away from not releasing. A year later from the release of that book, I had a literary agent. I had my first movie deal for that. And then a year later, I released a second novel, which is now 20th Century Fox. And so what I learned was, you know, good, you know, make something good. Understand what makes for something good. Good story, good plotting, make sure it's edited, you know, and don't try to do great, because you'll never know what great is. But good, you can shoot for, and good is almost a checklist. And that became sort of my attitude about stuff, is just do everything I know that makes for a good story and put my heart into that. Not stressing about trying to make something great, because I may never do that. I may never deliver. And if I hadn't written, you know, if I hadn't released that book, I wouldn't be in the position I am now. You know, being able to be a hybrid author, can do indie and works with HarperCollins. And so I guess my advice to writers is, like, hey, finish it, have a process to make it better and have a process to get better as a writer.
That's excellent. Now, I ask this of everybody. You're very busy. How do you balance your working life with your personal life?
Not well. When I was a teenager, when I was 15, I knew I wouldn't get married until I was probably in my 40s. And I figured that was because I was going to be a person that was always going to be following my muses. And that there are some people I know who are extremely good at life balance. You know, my brother, like, and my sister-in-law in particular, she's exceptional. She's a very well-respected corporate executive. She's a person, she's got two kids. She, you know, is, you know, married to my brother, which is probably a challenge unto itself, you know. And my brother's an FBI agent and a SWAT team, so he's, you know, at a moment's notice has to go off somewhere. She does that really well, and I know there's some personalities like that that can do that. I'm a singular focus type person that when I have one objective on my mind, that's the only thing I'm able to do. And I, because of that, I said, you know, I'm going to spend a large part of my life focusing on all my creative energies and probably won't be the best, you know, husband or father or whatever until probably later on in life. So I don't balance it well. I wish I had a better answer.
You know, that's fine. Everybody's different. I mean, I'm the reason I ask it is because I try to do it, and it's difficult for me. So I always ask it, maybe get an idea. And I have
you know, I would certainly say that, you know, you do have to understand how priorities work, and I think that you have to have a path to getting something done, and that I think that in my book, Plug Time, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, I talk a lot about how, as a writer, I have a section there called, like, you know, how to write a best-selling book on your iPhone. And I explain that when I talk to people, it's like, oh, I don't have time for this, I don't have the time for that. It's like, if the first time you think about your book is when you sit down in front of the blank screen, you're going to spend several hours in front of there. But if you're grabbing lunch, when I go to lunch, I bring notebooks with me, or I pull out my phone, I make little notes. I'm making little notes about characters. I'm making all these things. So when I sit down to write, all that work's kind of done for me, and these things come together, and you can really put things together very quickly if you do all that pre-work. And I think for people who have very busy lives, they could probably find more opportunities to get the pre-work done. So when they sit down to write, you know, if you write 1,500 words an hour and you can carve out, you know, 10 hours a week, which is actually not that hard for just about anybody. You know, it might be 45 minutes here, an hour there, but, you know, if you're doing 10 hours a week, you're doing 15,000 words a week, which, you know, you're writing in a month, you're doing a novel, if you're getting all that pre-work done. But a lot of times people, they sit down in front of that page and they rewrite that page over and over and over again because the first time they thought about it is then.
That's true. That's really true. We're coming to the end of the show, and I want people to be able to get in touch. You told them about your Facebook. Do you also have a website? Why don't you give them that information as well?
AndrewMayne.com, M-A-Y-N-E. And I will tell you, everybody, I give away a lot of my books. I'm very much a believer that anybody who signs up for my email list on there, if you sign up for my newsletter on there, just about, you know, anything I produce, you know, I try to give away copies of and just make that available because I kind of like the idea of using, you know, people who are subscribing to that and fans of my stuff. Is I think it's a great way to get people talking about books and talking about what I'm doing. So all the time I'm giving stuff away on there. So it's a genuine, that's my sort of, it's not a hook to get you to sign up for it. It's how I get people to give me reviews and talk about what I'm doing. So if you go to AndrewMayne.com and sign up for my email list, I'll make it worth your while.
You'll get a free book.
or several.
Or several. We're at the end. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed it. I hope you have too.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
And thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for chatting with Sherry. Thank you.